This is Chef John Falls welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio, and inviting you to join us at the kitchen table for another hour of adventures in food. Each week, we travel from the back roads of Louisiana to the streets of Europe's capitals, delving into food. We'll talk with chefs, food historians, authors, and producers. We'll search out current trends, revive forgotten traditions, and we might even cook for you. This Fat Tuesday, whether you're at the Curie de Mardi Gras in Eunice or on St. Charles Avenue with Rex in the Berth Gras, it's Mardi Gras time, so y'all laissez les bon temps rouler. Join me, Chef John Falls, and Wayne Phillips, textile curator at the Louisiana State Museum, as we talk about the one and only Mardi Gras on Stirring It Up next. But first, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Lyons. The acting president of Ukraine is reportedly ordering the armed forces to full readiness. That's in response to Russian President Vladimir Putin's decision to move troops into position in Crimea. The escalating tensions are prompting a chorus of criticism from the West to grow. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is calling for direct dialogue. Top members of the U.S. security team have met at the White House. And as Larry Miller reports, Britain's Foreign Office is warning Russia's ambassador to London not to intervene militarily.
Foreign Secretary William Hague says he's made Britain's position clear to the ambassador personally and in a phone call to Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov.
We condemn any act of aggression against Ukraine.
Hague says the Russian parliament's decision to authorize military force is potentially a grave threat to the sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity of Ukraine. He says he plans to speak with Secretary of State Kerry and other foreign leaders to coordinate diplomatic action. Hague goes to Kiev Sunday. He says he'll discuss the current crisis with Ukrainian leaders and offer to help the country recover assets that may have been stolen by the previous government. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
Drought-ridden Southern California is getting some much-needed rain this weekend, but NPR's Sam Sanders reports it's a mixed blessing for the region.
Los Angeles has gotten around 3 inches of rain over the last few days, about equal to all of last year's rain in the area. And some mountain areas outside of the city have gotten up to 8. There have been flash flood warnings throughout Los Angeles County and some evacuations. Now some of the same places that were in danger of wildfires are preparing for mudslides. Scott Sukup of the National Weather Service says the wet weather is good, but not enough to end a severe drought that's hurt every corner of the state.
In the long-term drought, it's not going to really do a whole lot. Most areas are going to still be a good 10 to 15 inches below normal for this season. So it's gonna take a couple years of above normal rainfall to get us back to where we should be.
Sukup says sunny skies will return by the end of the weekend. Sam Sanders, NPR News.
Officials in Washington State are taking steps to relieve the pressure at the Wanapum Dam after a 65-foot-long crack was discovered along the base. A utility spokesman says as a precautionary measure, the water above the dam is being drawn down about 20 feet while inspectors take a closer look at the crack. A dam failure in the rural area would affect primarily farmers, fishermen, and power generation. The St. Patrick's Day Parade in Boston is apparently easing its restriction on gay organizations participating. Under a tentative deal brokered by Boston Mayor Martin Walsh, parade organizers have agreed to let gay military veterans march with a marriage equality group. Anchorage, Alaska is filled with party animals today. Mushers and their dogs are participating in the ceremonial start to the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. This is NPR News in Washington. Witnesses tell the Xinhua News Agency knife-wielding attackers, most of them wearing black, entered a train station earlier today and started injuring people. By the time it was all over, at least 27 people had reportedly been killed, including 5 of the assailants. More than 100 others were injured. Xinhua says police are searching for others who may have gotten away. No word on who may be responsible. It comes right before the annual meeting of parliament opens in Beijing. A new Egyptian cabinet is in place after being sworn in today by the interim president. NPR's Leila Fadel reports the new government takes over from the old one, whose members resigned on Monday.
Field Marshal Abdel Fattah al-Sisi retained his position as defense minister and is the deputy prime minister. The new government was sworn in today and the process was aired on state television. One by one, the ministers swore an oath to protect the state and the constitution. The majority were the same faces as the last government, which resigned after intense criticism over its inability to deal with the failing economy, problems with security, and mass labor strikes. Critics say this government, like the last government, is somewhat powerless. The real power is in the military leadership. Sisi, the defense minister, is expected to run for president, but will first have to resign from the government. There is no date yet for the presidential elections. Leila Fadel, NPR News, Cairo.
Nigeria's president is under pressure to contain violence after today's bomb attack in the northeast city of Maiduguri. At least 10 people were killed when a bomb exploded in a crowded marketplace. I'm Nancy Lyons, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
For the finest in classic ska, rock steady, rockers, DJ, dance hall, and dub, it's Jamon. Cecil here, bringing you Southwest Louisiana's longest running reggae tradition, Jamon. Jamon Sunday nights from 9 to 11 p.m. or Saturday mornings from 1 to 3 a.m. and streaming live anytime at krvs.org.
Chef John Falls welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. All right, everybody, welcome to the kitchen table, and thank you so much for joining us just about 4 days away from Mardi Gras. And I'll tell you what, Michelle, you notice I'm in costume.
Yeah, you're going as a chef, I see.
I'll tell you what, and I just got a scolding by one of our finest little Louisiana state troopers because I was coming down the highway, and I had my apron on, and I have to admit I was going just a little fat, but I was anxious to get to the big kitchen table today, and the trooper stopped me and got my license out and everything else, and he says, Chef, you were going 5 miles over the speed limit.
Five?
I said,
oh, you're making that up.
I'm not. I said five.
I said
I was going 5 miles over the speed limit. I apologize. I said, what happened was this. I have a radio show I got going, and some kind of way or other, there was an accident over there on the airline. He said, there was no accident. I've been listening on my radio. I said, okay, I was lying. So he started laughing. He said, I tell you what I'm going to do. He said, because I know you're going somewhere to do something for somebody, so I'm going to follow you the way you're going. To say, I'm going to my office right now. I'm going to do a radio
show. Had a police escort.
I had a police escort. And let me tell you what. Nice. I want to thank the Louisiana State Police, and I want to thank Colonel Edmondson, Michael Edmondson, because I'll tell you what. He does an unbelievable job because that troop was very nice to me, and he could have written me a ticket because I broke the law. But he said, let me guide you the way you're going so you don't hurt anybody.
Now that is a good thing. I wonder if we could hire him permanently to escort you everywhere.
Well, I tell you, I love the Louisiana State Police. Let me tell you what, they're good guys. I tell you
yes,
right
they
now,
are.
Anytime I can do anything for them, I try my best. Not because that gave me an escort for 8 blocks, but I needed
eight
escort. That's all it was, 8 blocks. That's right by the interstate over there. Anyway, y'all, how you doing today? I have Michelle York here right before Mardi Gras. What's your big plans for Mardi Gras anyway?
I don't know. I'm probably writing a paper.
You're writing a paper.
I think that's going to be my big Mardi Gras.
What about you, Slama? What do you do for Mardi Gras?
I'm actually going to be in Colorado this year.
Oh.
Yeah, we're going to go do that the thing that some of the locals do. We're going to go up the mountains, do some Mardi Gras skiing.
Yeah. Anyway, Michelle, you notice how many king cakes went out of our door UPS this year?
my gosh.
I don't know what was going on out there.
You know, and this is the shame of it all. I'm talking about thousands of king cakes that went out. And every day you walk through the bakery and they're painting. they've got, they're airbrushing the king cakes.
With icing, that's
with
right.
With icing. And the shame of all of it is that I've only had one of our king cakes.
One king cake.
That well,
now I'm just saying.
What flavor?
Oh, I think it was raspberry.
What?
It was delicious. Right. Oh, can't we have another one?
Well, just as long as you don't pick up one of them babies or nothing. We don't need none of that to curtail our schedules around here. Anyway, Michelle, you won't see me waving for beads, but you might find me begging for chicken because, you know, every year or so I try to go to that Cunita Mardi Gras in Eunice over there near Church Point where they make the big communal gumbo. I want to be where the food is. I don't want to just throw me something missed or stuff. I want to throw me a chicken.
But what makes this day different than any other? You always begging for a chicken.
That's a good
but
point.
I have to say, that is a vision of you in one of those fringed, have you seen those, Llama? The fringed patchwork costumes
and the wire masks, the capuchons
on their head, the tall capuchons.
That's those pointed dunce kind of cap. But this goes back to medieval times. I mean, you got to remember, Mardi Gras goes way back. Anyway, you might mock, but those costumes are based, as I mentioned, on real tradition, all the way back to medieval times. And it was all about poking fun at the nobility, the clergy, the intellectuals of the day. The tall pointy hats, or the capuchons, as they call it, imitated the ones worn by the noble women of the day.
You're dressing up as a woman. Yeah. Is that what you just said?
No, but you remember when we watched the Medicis, and all the women were walking with the pointed hats and the veils
and all that.
The capuchons, that's what. And so the original Mardi Gras, Cunita Mardi Gras, was for the poor people, and they ran through the streets begging for chicken or for meats to make their communal pot of food. Today, the Cunita Mardi Gras is still taking place in Eunice, Louisiana, that little bitty Cajun town. And yes, they're still on horseback and on wagons with music and everything else, chasing chickens and onto a sausage and rice to make
on
that
the wagon the... and off the wagon during that day, because there's a lot of beverage. Everybody passes a good time. But, you know, the carnival celebration, you're right, did flourish in medieval times. But it actually started in ancient Rome with Lupercalia. It was a festival in February. And once Rome embraced Christianity, the pagan circus-like ritual, which fell right before Lent, was retained. It was just given a Christian twist, a Christian interpretation. Carnival actually moved from Venice into France, where they celebrated the Bouffe Gras. And eventually it found its way to the colonies.
Yeah, and you know, I'm teaching a culinary class at Nichols at my culinary school over there. And in fact, just a couple of days ago, we were talking about Tuesday, March the 3rd, 1699, Louisiana's first Mardi Gras was religiously observed about 36 miles from the mouth of the Mississippi River at the westward bend. It was Iberville and Bienville and their crew. Well, I think Bienville was still a little bit up the river, but Iberville and his crew spent their second night on the right bank of the river. And he noted in his journals that we have given the name to this point Mardi Gras because they realized that back home in France, everybody was celebrating because tomorrow was Ash Wednesday and just happened to remember that. I think it was kind of a fluke, but they did celebrate. And that was on March the 3rd, 1699. Can you imagine?
I think it's interesting that it was religiously observed. I guess I kind of wonder what that means, the Mardi Gras day, that it was religiously observed. Did they just do it as a faithful thing, or was it truly in anticipation of Lent? And then I wonder, did they do anything on Ash Wednesday? But they were so impoverished already. I mean, right. Sleeping on the side of the river in the mud. I can't imagine that there was very much that they, much more they could give up and sacrifice. Well, but you know, whether we're running in the Cree or rolling in a parade, Mardi Gras truly is the best party on earth. And while the parades that run along Canal Street and St. Charles Avenue are part of the tradition, there are many other kind of offbeat parades that are truly intriguing in their own right.
I mean, like Louisiana, I mean, there's, what, seven different nations, all the different cultures coming together here. And that's true that there's so many different cultures and so many different customs that it really is the heart, the city of Mardi Gras. One of the marching crews of the Mardi Gras season is the crew of Cork, that's C-O-R-K, as in a wine bottle. These lovers of the grape, they get up real early and they start to march through the French Quarter in celebration of naturally wine, food, and fun. There's also the New Orleans four-legged furry revelers that parade with their owners through the streets of the Quarter. And you know, they're the crew of Barkus.
I love the crew of Barkus.
That's the little dog. And if you hadn't seen this parade, you might think that Mardi Gras had gone to the dogs, but not but not so. This parade is a howling good time.
Well, here's one you wouldn't want to miss. The Divas, or Divine Protectors of Endangered Pleasures Marching Crew.
I'm a member of that crew.
It's an all-female group that prances their way down Bourbon and Royal in their signature beaded bustiers, escorted by the Elvi. Yep. That's right, members of the crew of Elvis. And once they ensure that the pleasures, such as taking naps and long walks and extended conversations, once they're sure that all that's protected for another year, only then do they consider their job well done.
And up the line in Baton Rouge, of course, Baton Rouge has its own traditions, the state capital, of course, LSU, Southern University. You can imagine the streets of South Downs, this little neighborhood near the capital, has its own tradition lined with revelers. You'll be hard-pressed, I think, to find a lawn or a driveway that doesn't have a gumbo pot cooking or something on a grill for neighbors who want to stop by and visit between all of the bead-catching. Spanish Town, which I actually participated in a couple of years ago, is a great satirical parade. Now, sometimes their themes can get a little
bawdy.
Well, a bit on the shady side, so to speak, of the body side. But fun, no less, absolutely. They can make fun of everybody you can imagine. So much so that the Spanish Town Parade has its own irreverent group of loyal followers year after year, and it's growing and growing and growing.
I just hope we never see our faces on one of those floats. That'd be bad. I never want to see a John Foles.
Your face on one of the floats.
Though I haven't gone in years to Spanish Town, I love that parade. And another one that I've been to in the past is the Chifuncta Riverboat Parade, which truly is awesome. It's hosted right there in that charming little historic town of Madisonville. Beautiful community. A procession of boats ride up the river, and they end along Water Street. They tie up there, and they throw beads, among other things, to the crowd. And it's just so unique. So the floats are actually on the water, only in Louisiana.
You know, there's also the Society de St. Anne Parade, founded in 1969 by Mardi Gras historian Henry Schindler. And that starts off in the Bywater. Oh. The flamboyant Mardi Gras Indians, of course, march early on Mardi Gras Day. Now, let me tell you, these crews of African-American men are renowned for their ornate, feathered, and beaded costumes. They can loosely trace their origins to the 1880s, 1885, when Buffalo Bill brought his Wild West show to New Orleans. It's thought that the original clubs identified with the plight of the Native Americans. The Wild Magnolias, the White Eagles, the Golden Arrows are a few of the crew names, and new tribes from this particular crew are farming at all times. So that's the Mardi Gras Indian crew.
And their costumes.
Their costumes are some of the most interesting in the city.
Absolutely. And then you have the Jefferson City Buzzards.
Oh.
They get started early on Mardi Gras Day, about 6:45 in the morning, and they've been marching since 1890, making them the oldest marching club.
Can you, my favorite, though, Pete Fountain and his half-fast walking club.
Absolutely.
His half-fast, they start at 7:45 in the morning, you know, my God.
So whether you float, bark, thrill at the sight of beads and feathers, or just love passing a good time at a parade, there's a Louisiana Mardi Gras celebration for absolutely everyone. We didn't even talk about the Houma parades and Lafayette.
That's what I'm saying. All of the surrounding neighborhoods. There's great family parades. There's great parades with a lot of ruckus, but all of them are safe, and they're a lot of fun. The police do an incredible job in all of the towns. The security is incredible. It is a family event that everybody can enjoy. And, y'all, it's time for us to take a break, but when we come back, we have a great guest who is well-versed in all of that majesty of Mardi Gras. You don't want to miss it, and it's only 4 days away.
Well,
we'll be back in a minute.
Greetings, I'm Jake Abair.
And I'm Adam Chouard. Join us every Friday at midnight for the Sound Club radio program.
Your home for left field pop gems from today to yesteryear.
Here on 88.7 FM KRVS.
Hi, I'm Pete Bergeron. If your day starts early, like mine does, let's spend it together with Cajun music from 5 to 7 a.m. here at Public Radio for Acadiana, KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting food and culture show on radio. And today, Michelle, we're talking about one of our favorite subjects of all. We're talking about a season of the year that has revelry and, well, a little bit of a good food tied into it as well. And, of course, celebration. We're talking about Mardi Gras. It's only in, what, today's the first, so it's going to be in 4 days, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, the parades are rolling.
Well, they're rolling already.
They're rolling.
They've been rolling since last year.
They never stop rolling, actually, I guess.
Even though they're not officially called Mardi Gras parades, they're rolling all year. Anyway, yeah, that was a great conversation. That was nice to line out all those different parades and everything.
I know,
just
very interesting. Very interesting to talk about some of the unusual.
And I bet each and every one of them has a different little costume twist to them of some way or another. But anyway, I know we have a great guest who's going to be with us and of course, going to tell us everything we need to know about that subject. Why don't you go ahead and introduce him?
Absolutely. Today, our guest is Wayne Phillips. He is the textile curator at the Louisiana State Museum there in New Orleans. Wayne has been curator of costumes and textiles at the museum since 1998. He started with the museum working in the exhibits division, but soon he was promoted to curator. He's responsible for a collection of over 20,000 items.
Wow.
That, among other great Louisiana artifacts, includes this encyclopedic collection of carnival memorabilia. 1,000 costumes and accessories, hundreds of original costume and float designs, thousands of original photographs and ball favors and parade throws, all sorts of items that document all aspects of Louisiana carnival celebrations statewide. He's a cum laude graduate of Vanderbilt University. He concentrated in art history and French language and literature. Then he made his way down to God's country.
I bet it was carnival that brought him here.
Had to be
what enticed him.
Wayne, welcome to Stirring It Up. We are thrilled to have you with us today.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be with you guys. And, of course, you can put me on the radio anytime to talk about Mardi Gras, and you will probably have a hard time shutting me up.
We need to first, you know, this interview and this conversation has been a year in the making, because last year we had some technical difficulties. Wayne was going to be with us, and we just had technical issues that day with phone lines and damage, and we didn't get to...
Wayne, I have to tell you, I'm constantly on them about keeping my equipment up to date around here.
And you'll be proud to know we all have new headsets today.
Wayne, for someone in charge of thousands and thousands of things and keeping them all in proper order, you can understand my frustration when we couldn't get you on the phone last year.
Oh, it wasn't pretty.
I understand.
Things were being thrown, but it wasn't Mardi Gras beads.
Right.
So, you know, what a privilege it must be to be one of the protectors of Louisiana history. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. Nothing excites me more than to go into a museum or a library and they hand me a pair of white gloves because I know I'm about to see something good.
Well, so, you're right. It's a privilege for me, and I'm blessed to have this job, believe me.
Now, you just completed some work on an exhibit that actually commemorates one of our oldest crews. Tell us about that exhibit, well, and the collection as a whole.
Well, the collection that we have here at the Louisiana State Museum is the largest in the state of carnival materials as well as historical clothing and textiles. And I always tell people when I bring them into my storage room, anything that you have ever worn, we have something like it in the museum. And I mean that. I mean that from your, you know, your shirts and your pants and your socks and shoes, your jewelry, even your underwear. We have historical underwear in the collection going all the way back to the 1800s. And, of course, we have lots and lots of Mardi Gras costumes. So, you know, it's always a pleasure to be able to look back at the history of Mardi Gras and look at some of the moments that really made history. And one of the things that we have discovered recently with some new scholarship is the importance of the crew of Hermes. Mm-hmm. The crew of Hermes, of course, is one of the big crews here in New Orleans, and they parade on the Friday night before Mardi Gras, and they've done that since the very beginning. This is their 75th year.
Wow.
So they're celebrating a big anniversary this year. And what was kind of important about them is that they grew out of the Great Depression. So they got started in the 1930s at a time when other Mardi Gras crews were kind of scaling back, and Mardi Gras was on the wane a little bit. So Hermes came along with the help from some of the older crews to kind of get started, and from the very first year in 1937, they were a huge hit, and they've only grown bigger and stronger ever since then. And it just so happens, completely by coincidence, when we started talking to the crew about doing this exhibit, I don't think they even knew at the beginning that Hermes is the only crew in the state for which we have a costume from the very first year the crew existed. We have the Queen's gown in our collection from 1937.
Oh, my gosh.
And we've had that in the collection since the 70s, and I don't think it's even ever been exhibited. So this was the time to bring it out and put it in the context of the whole history of the crew.
That's what always excites me. There's so many beautiful things and artifacts that we see, but so many that are in the archives that just there's not enough room to display. I always want one of those behind-the-scenes tours.
Well, and we do those. In fact, we've just completed doing our carnival hidden treasures tours that I do every year during the season. And the other collections here at the museum, the decorative arts, visual arts, the archive, the science and technology collection, each one of these collections has a special behind-the-scenes tour that we call Hidden Treasures throughout the year. So if folks want to see behind the scenes and actually come into our storage rooms and see all the wonderful things that we have in storage, then they have an opportunity to do that. And that helps us communicate the fact that, you know, museums aren't just in the business of doing beautiful exhibits. The preservation of artifacts is actually where it all starts. Mm-hmm. And any museum the size of ours has far more in storage than we could ever possibly display. So we want to make the collection accessible and familiar and help people really understand that this is a public collection. This collection belongs to the state. It's held in trust for the people of Louisiana. And we don't want to hide things away. We don't want there to all be all these secrets behind the walls. We want to bring people into the storage rooms, you know, respecting security and respecting the accessibility to the collection, and like you said, you know, wearing the white gloves and all of that. So we want to make people proud of the collection that we have held in trust for them for over 100 years.
And Wayne, the origin of a lot of these pieces, is there a day when someone walks in and there's some piece walking through the door that just excites you, or is it a constant search for the artifacts that may have been hidden away in an attic of a home somewhere? Where are these beautiful pieces or rare pieces coming from?
You know, you would not believe where these things come from. They literally come from all over the country and all over the world. 99% of what is in our collection is donated. So I get phone calls all year long. I always say I love answering the telephone because I just never know what it's going to be. It could be this amazing discovery that I've been waiting for, and I have had several of those. but sometimes literally these things will walk in the door. Probably the best example of that is, gosh, probably about 10 years ago, a gentleman walked into the Presbyter, which is our museum on Jackson Square, where we have a permanent Mardi Gras exhibit, and he was carrying a gold pocket watch. And he told the security guard at the front desk in the Presbyter that the pocket watch belonged to his great-grandfather, and his great-grandfather was the first president of the crew of Proteus. Now, the crew of Proteus is one of what we call the old line crews here in New Orleans. Their very first parade took place in 1882, and his great-grandfather was the first president of the board of that crew, and the gold pocket watch was presented to him by the members of the organization in gratitude for his service as president, and it was engraved with his name, with the crew's name, and the date.
Wow.
And this gentleman walked in the front door. He was here on a conference, and he was from Canada. So at some point, the family moved away from New Orleans.
Wow.
And this you'll find amusing. He wanted to know if there was a phone number for the crew of Proteus. Now, if you know anything about a crew like the old line crews, you know there's a lot of secrecy with the membership of those crews. And he just didn't know that
because
he was so far removed from the origin of the crew and his great-grandfather's participation with the crew. So the security guard called me and said, can you help this gentleman? And I had to explain, no, there's no phone number that you can call, but I can help you with all the historical questions. And to his great surprise, I persuaded him to leave the watch with us.
Oh, my gosh.
And that was one of the things that, I just love those moments when people walk in the door and they have these treasures and these stories to tell. Because, we don't just collect artifacts, we collect stories. So.
Oh, my God, of course. Mm-hmm.
Very important.
Unbelievable stories, I'm sure, just like that one. Wayne, the celebration of Mardi Gras, it almost petered out. It almost died out in the 1850s. Can you share with us what the cause was and then the ultimate salvation that prevented its demise? Because I cannot imagine New Orleans and Louisiana without Mardi Gras today.
I know. Can you imagine Mardi Gras possibly dying out?
No.
Never happened. Never.
It's such an integral part of our culture, and that's what I try to explain, especially to visitors from out of state when they come here. Mardi Gras is not just a party. Mardi Gras really is a part of our history and our culture, and it's also a part of our business and industry. Mardi Gras employs people throughout the year and has provided a great deal of artistry and, gives people careers. But if you go back about 150 years, over 150 years to the 1840s and 1850s, it did almost die out because it was very disorganized during that time period. There were no Mardi Gras crews before the late 1850s. So Mardi Gras was essentially a spontaneous, rather mischievous and outrageous celebration, not the kind of widespread cultural attraction that we have today. Mardi Gras at the time was really, limited mostly to New Orleans rather than any other parts of the state. And you might have a couple of hundred people on the street who would put on masks and kind of roam about the old part of the city, which is what we know as the French Quarter now. Homemade costumes, and they would commit acts of mischief. It was very common at the time for these men. The women did not costume at the time. It was considered immodest and inappropriate for women to wear costumes. So it was only men who participated at the time. And they would throw things at each other. They would throw mud at each other, and they would throw flour at each other, and all kinds of odds and ends. And it was getting a little out of hand. Some of these people were throwing mud and flour at people who were not in costume. It was just getting a little rowdy. And also there was a spate of several years in the 1850s where the weather on Mardi Gras year after year after year was bad. And it just caused a decline in participation. And the newspapers at the time started calling for an end to the celebration of Mardi Gras because it was out of control and there was no sense of organization to it. And it was just kind of almost expiring.
Right. And then I guess the Civil War came right behind that and also shut things down for quite a while.
Yeah, you're right. War really is the only time where Mardi Gras in Louisiana is pretty much canceled. That was the case during the Civil War, also during World War I and World War II, and even during the Korean War in the early 50s. Those were really the only times that Mardi Gras was fully canceled for several years at a time. In the late 1850s, there was a new attempt to create some sense of organization for Mardi Gras and make it a little bit more predictable and straightened up and cleaned up a little bit, but the Civil War followed that organization pretty quick. But the good news is that right after the Civil War, let's say in about 1866, Mardi Gras came back stronger than before, and we've had it ever since.
Now, in 1857, I understand that was Comus held their first parade and ball that year. So Mardi Gras kind of took on a completely different look and style of what you were just describing. Can you tell us about some of the early crew of Comus parade themes, events? Because they were, I think, kind of special, especially looking back at, we always look back to see what the food and beverage, how that may have played in the feasting and the, you know, before the fasting.
Sure, yeah. Comus, we have to give a lot of credit to Comus. The Mystic Crew of Comus, as it's called, is really considered sort of the grandfather of all Mardi Gras crews. They had their very first ball and parade in 1857, and they were a private men's organization that was founded to give a sense of predictability and organization to Mardi Gras. It was a very small parade the first year. Most of the people in the parade were on foot. There were only two floats in that very first parade. And the theme of the first parade was John Milton's Paradise Lost, which, of course, draws from English literature, which is the irony of the founding of the Mystic Crew of Comus, is because most of the men who founded this new organization that they called a crew were of Anglo-Saxon descent. You know, we think of Mardi Gras as coming from the French Creole or Caribbean roots of Louisiana's history, but the men who sort of reshaped Mardi Gras and reorganized it in the 1850s were mostly of Anglo descent. And so a lot of the themes that they drew from in the early years in the late 1850s and into the 1860s drew from English literature and English history. In fact, one of the themes was the history of England. The first theme, of course, was Paradise Lost from John Milton's story. And one of the themes was mythology, which, of course, has lasted now over 150 years as a very common theme. And, in fact, many of the Mardi Gras crews are named after mythological figures. But Comus was really the crew that sort of gave a shape and a look to Mardi Gras that we're still following today. So we have to give them a lot of credit for keeping it going.
What about Rex? I mean, most people will immediately think of Rex when you talk about Mardi Gras established in 1872, that motto, pro bono publico. Tell us a little bit about Rex and Comus's, I guess, their they represent, I guess, to the nation, probably two of the most important crews out there, right?
Oh, you're absolutely right. When Rex came along in 1872, they were a hit and a success from the very beginning. What we have to remember about crews like Comus and a couple of crews that followed them in the 1860s, 1870s, is that their parades were at nighttime. Their membership was secret. Their king, who, you know, paraded in the parade on a special float, he was in a mask. His name was not revealed to the public. So there was a lot of secrecy, a lot of kind of anonymity and mystery about those first couple of crews. And then when Rex came along in 1872, they wanted to have a daytime parade. They wanted to be a little bit more visible. Their king's name was made public. And, of course, we know that, you know, the face of the King of Carnival every year is on the cover of the newspaper here in New Orleans, and he's interviewed on the news and public television and on the radio. So Rex has come to symbolize sort of Mardi Gras overall, and the king of the Rex organization, who is called Rex himself, he is the king of all New Orleans carnival. And that emblem that they use, the motto pro bono publico, which has been used by Rex from the very beginning, is the Latin phrase that means for the good of the public. So Rex always intended to be to have a more public face. And as a result, the influence of Rex has been felt not only here in the state, but even beyond Louisiana's borders. There are a variety of crews that got started in the wake of Rex forming that modeled themselves after Rex, not only the organization of the crew, but even the name. There were kings of Mardi Gras and Mardi Gras-type organizations in other parts of Louisiana and even out of state who called their king Rex. So Rex really sort of became the leading crew from the very beginning in 1872.
Wow. we don't have much time. Can you hold on over until the next break, Wayne? Because we still have a list of questions.
Of course, I'd love to.
Okay.
Well, y'all, we have a great conversation going on. And, of course, I guess the most often asked questions are being answered right now by our guests. So it's really so nice to have Wayne with us. And we're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back in just a second. So don't you dare go anywhere. Haiko, haiko, hande, Giacomo, filo, handane, Giacomo, pinane, oh, look at my queen all dressed in red. Haiko, haiko, hande, I bet you $5 she'll kill you dead.
Hello, I'm Georges Collinet. On Afropop Worldwide, we take you on a journey through the South Africa of today, guided by the rising stars and established luminaries we met at the inaugural South African Music and Arts Festival in Los Angeles, California. We explore the diverse contemporary scene of rappers, folk singers, house music producers, and electropop bands. Next time on Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday night at 8 on KRVS.
Hi everyone, this is Pat Mitchell-Worley, and coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan, we're going to hear from Roots music phenom Jake Bug. And Bill Street Caravan contributor Adam Hill will be continuing his series Made in Memphis. That's all coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan.
Tonight at 11 on KRVS.
Comics avec Val. Bienvenue dans le monde francophone. C'est tous les jeudis à 9h sur KRVS, la radio Acadie.
You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, and on the web at krvs.org. Find us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio, and it's so nice to have you with us just a couple of days before one of the nation's great celebrations of Mardi Gras. Michelle, we have a fabulous guest filling in all of the blanks for us today. And you had a question of Wayne before.
I do. Well, I just wanted to remind everybody that we're talking to Wayne Phillips, textile curator at the Louisiana State Museum there in New Orleans.
That's his official title, but he should be...
We should probably call him Rex.
He should be Rex.
We should probably call... Yeah, that's right. Wayne, you were just telling us a little bit about Rex and how it became a daytime parade and announced who the king was. But they're really responsible for a lot of our Mardi Gras traditions, are they not?
Oh, for sure, especially the daytime parade. You know, like I was saying, most of the crews that were formed before Rex, there were really only just two or three, had their parades at night and kind of hid behind this veil of secrecy, which, frankly, those crews that still exist, they still do that. They still have a great deal of secrecy. There's a great deal of secrecy with Rex as well, but, you know, their king, he's on the cover of the paper, his name is everywhere, and he parades in the daytime, so that makes a big difference. Rex really kind of took the lead in terms of sort of representing Mardi Gras. And in so doing, what they used to do is they used to put proclamations in the newspaper, not only here, but throughout the region. In fact, the term proclamation is a term that we still use today because in the late 1970s, Rex started this tradition of creating a proclamation as a poster, a fine art poster that you can actually walk into a store and buy. And the proclamation tradition goes all the way back to the very first year when there was an announcement put in the paper saying, you know, please come to New Orleans for Mardi Gras. Rex welcomes you. Rex beckons you to Mardi Gras. And then over the course of time, it turned into this goofy little document that was kind of handed out to the press. But then eventually it turned into a poster, and then that kind of started the whole poster tradition in the late 1970s, too. Arriving on the shore of the river, the Mississippi River here in New Orleans, on the Monday before Fat Tuesday, there was a special yacht that was commissioned to bring the King of Carnival to New Orleans as if he were coming from some faraway land, some mythological land, and he would land on the river, and then they would have just a short parade where he would go and greet the mayor at City Hall. And then also some of the floats that Rex introduced, namely the Bouffe Gras, which is the fatted calf float. In the 19th century, they actually had a bull on a float, like a live bull, which, of course, goes back centuries and centuries, the idea of parading a fatted calf or a bull through the streets of the city as sort of the last great meal before the penance and sacrifice of Lent begins the next day on Ash Wednesday. So Rex really introduced so many traditions that we still carry on in Carnival today.
And what about the anthem, the If Ever I Cease to Love?
Oh, for sure. That goes all the way back to the very early years, too, the very first year in 1872. If Ever I Cease to Love was a song that was popular in the dance halls of the day. It had been popularized by a particular songstress who was well-known throughout the country, and it was being performed in New Orleans in 1872, that first year that Rex came along. And Rex kind of co-opted it and used it as their theme. And believe it or not, you know, almost 150 years later, we're still using this old 19th century song that nobody else in the country would remember. But everybody here in town knows that theme and can instantly recognize it.
I've often heard that the 1880s and 1890s referred to as the golden era of Mardi Gras. Were those the golden years? Why did they refer to them this way?
Well, the golden era of Mardi Gras definitely was the 1880s, 1890s, and a little bit into the early 20th century as well. One of the things that we have to remember about that time that's easy to forget is that there were only a handful of crews in New Orleans at the time. There was Comus, Rex, Proteus, Momus, Twelfth Night Revelers, and maybe two or three others. So there was a lot of money that was being concentrated on a very small number of crews. Today, we have over 100 Mardi Gras crews in New Orleans and around the state, maybe even, you know, 150 if you count everything around the state. But there were just this handful, you know, a 6 to 8 crews in the 1880s and 1890s. So a lot of money was being lavished on the look of the parades and the artistry that went into the style and design of not only the parades, but the costumes and the ball invitations and the dance cards and the crowns and scepters that the kings and queens were wearing. So a lot of money was concentrated on a relatively small celebration. And the crews at the time wanted to hire the best artists that they could to do all this design work. And it also coincided with, you know, artistic movements that were popular at the time, the aesthetic movement in the 1880s, the coming of Art Nouveau in the 1890s. These were looks that were very heavy on decoration and embellishment and lavish style. So it was a magical time in Mardi Gras history.
Wayne, when we talk about the jewels and, of course, the beads and the favors and the doubloons, has that been a part of Mardi Gras for quite a while, or did it just get more elaborate each year?
It has been a part of Mardi Gras for a long time. The crowns and scepters, you know, I love our collection of crowns and scepters here at the museum. In fact, in the Presbyter, our museum on Jackson Square, where we have our permanent Mardi Gras exhibit, we have one room where we have all of the best crowns and scepters and jewels in our collection on display. We call it our Crown Jewels Vault because it really does give you this feel of like this vault of precious gemstones when you walk into it. In fact, the room where those materials are on display used to be the museum vault. The vault door is actually still attached to the room. And those were important symbols of being a king and queen from the very early years. I think the earliest piece that we had the crown and scepter that were worn by the Queen of Carnival in 1877.
Oh, my God.
And that was only the fifth the fifth year, sixth year that Rex actually had a ball and parade. The tradition of favors comes along pretty soon after that. Let's say by the 1880s, the crews were starting to give away little pieces of jewelry or little trinkets to particularly the women who were invited to attend their ball, because it was mostly jewelry, little pins, which are very, very collectible today. And then when you get into the throws, you know, there's a history of people throwing things from the floats. By the 1870s, there may have been one or two guys on one of these floats that just decided to throw a few pieces of candy or something, and that's kind of where it got its start. It wasn't until the early 1920s, again with Rex being that, you know, crew that almost all crews look back to for inspiration, where some of the members started throwing a few odds and ends here and there, and these were small trinkets, glass beads, that many people will remember because the glass beads were thrown well into the 1960s. And then over the course of time, of course, as crews got bigger and there were more crews, they were looking to economize a little bit, so the glass beads became plastic beads. And then eventually the plastic beads became big plastic beads. And then you turned into all these amazing sort of, you know, technological innovations with CDs and DVDs and blinky beads and things with moving parts. So, you know, the throwing of trinkets from the floats has really changed.
Yeah, a lot of different throws today. Sketches of some of those early float designs and the costumes, very elegant, beautiful, a lot of, as you had said earlier, fantastical themes, but beautiful artwork. The artistry really was incredible. Who were some of those artists, and who do we have doing this today? Who's following in their footsteps?
Well, the early artists that we know about, fortunately, have been exhaustively researched and are, you know, a matter of public record. My good friend Henri Schindler, who is someone that many people may be familiar with, has done more than anybody in recent years to really shed light and give proper attention to the artists of Carnival. He's written a series of books going back about 15 years in his Mardi Gras Treasures series, where he talks about the float designers and the costume designers and the jewelry designers and ball invitation designers, and he's done so much research about them. And these are really important artists that we have to add to sort of the canon of Louisiana art history. The very first named artist that we know was a man named Charles Britton. And what's kind of ironic about Britton is that he was not American, he was not English, he was not French, he was Swedish.
Wow.
Now, you know, we know that there has never been a large Scandinavian influx into Louisiana when we study the history of immigration into our state. But as a Swedish artist, he came to the United States in the 1860s. And by about 1870, we know that he was here in New Orleans, and he was designing Mardi Gras floats, costumes, and the balls, the sets for the balls. So Britton is our first artist. He's kind of the king. He's the big celebrity when we look back at who were the earliest artists. And then following him, we have some names like Jenny Wild is a good example. Jenny is one of the first female artists who was actually designing not only the costumes and the ball invitations and the jewelry, but she was even designing the floats. I mean, think about a woman having the ability to have a career as a float designer in the 1890s. That's why I think it's really important to talk about artists like Jenny Wild. And she had a contemporary designer that worked alongside her whose name was Carlotta Bonkaus. Carlotta and Jenny were the first two women working as professional carnival designers, designing floats, costumes, and the whole look of a parade. So, you know, there's this sort of historical element to Mardi Gras that goes beyond the party aspect, and we have to talk about the art and give credit to these extraordinary artists who created the look of Mardi Gras in the late 19th and early 20th century.
Well, Wayne, you mentioned Schindler's books, and of course, when you look at his books of jewelry of the Golden Age and invitations from that same period, Golden Age costume designs, I mean, the books are just absolutely fantastic, and we're going to certainly put those on our website, jfalls.com, so anyone interested in viewing these beautiful reproductions in the book are just absolutely magnificent. Float designs, everything in a collection of books. One last question. You've been so generous with your time at a very busy time of year for you. Tell us a little bit about the museum itself, when it's open, what can people expect, how did he get there, any exhibits currently going on naturally with Mardi Gras?
Well, just so that your listeners know really what the Louisiana State Museum is, of course, we are the official state historical museum. I'm a public employee of the state of Louisiana, and the State Museum is a statewide institution. Our headquarters are here in New Orleans, where my office is, and here in New Orleans, people will know the State Museum better as the Cabildo and the Presbyter and the Old U.S. Mint, as well as a couple of other museums here in New Orleans. But we also have museums, big museum in Baton Rouge. We have a historical museum in Patterson, museum in Thibodeau, and our brand new museum is all the way up in Natchitoches, so we're statewide. But what I do, spending most of my time working on Mardi Gras, is focused on the permanent Mardi Gras exhibit, which is on the second floor of the Presbyter on Jackson Square, open year-round, open every day except Monday. And we also have a changing gallery that we change out once a year. That's where our new Crew of Hermes exhibit is. So anybody who wants to really see the whole history of Mardi Gras, it's a big exhibit. One of the biggest Mardi Gras exhibits we've ever done. Lots of beautiful old costumes on display, even a full-size float on display in the exhibit. So I always invite people to come to the Presbyter many, many times throughout the year. And I have lots of people tell me that they always bring their guests, their out-of-town visitors to the Presbyter, even, you know, outside the carnival season, so that they can learn a little bit of history of carnival.
Well, Wayne, let me say, and I know Michelle can certainly shout accolades for all of the work that you do and the museum structure in general. I know Culture, Recreation, and Tourism and our Lieutenant Governor has put so much time along with you guys who really make it happen every day. And you are there for us, everybody out there doing research, everyone just wanting to come and enjoy the sights and sounds of the museums. I don't think anybody does it better than Louisiana, and certainly the uniqueness of the collections in Louisiana are just so important. And it's people like you who make it accessible and make it real and have it available to us. And we thank you so much for being with us today. And thanks a lot, and happy Mardi Gras to you.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Same to you and all your listeners.
Yeah, we appreciate you. What a great guy he is.
Yes, indeed.
Wow. And, y'all, we will have all of the information that Wayne just shared with us on our website, jfalls.com. Michelle,
yes.
Anything you want to mention?
Yes, the first one I want to quickly mention, Rex, an illustrated history of the School of Design by Stephen Hales. Rex, of course, King of Carnival. And also the four books by Henry Schindler. Beautiful books, Mardi Gras Treasures series, certainly worthwhile to have in your Louisiana collection. Oh, and one more, Madame Begay's Recipes of Old New Orleans.
And Papa Tucker is the one who just redid that
she
book.
Did.
So she did.
She did
a great job, yeah.
So that's kind of fun.
Anyway, y'all, we only have 30 seconds left, but if you go to our website, jfalls.com, you're going to find our Crab Cake Rex. You're going to find our Cajun Cure for a Hangover. You're going to find our Zulu, King Zulu Bread Pudding recipe, which is absolutely fantastic. Our Crab Cakes Rex are to die for, and crab meat is so great in Louisiana. So anyway, we have a lot of great recipes there. Don't forget our Facebook page, facebook.com/stirringitupradio. Make sure you go visit us and share with us your thoughts about the big show. Happy Mardi Gras, everybody. Be safe.
Join me for a chance to discover artists whose music reaches across the Atlantic in both directions. New artists from North America, new recordings from some you know. In our New World releases, this week on the Thistle and Shamrock.
Coming up Sunday evening at 6, here on KRVS.
I'm going to Rocky Island.
Tune in every Saturday night at midnight for The Diamond Sea, a weekly mixtape featuring the best in independent music from the 80s, 90s, and today. here on 88.7 KRVS, public radio for Acadiana.
This is Helen Forster from E-Town. We've got two incredible musical legends with us this week. Folk icon David Bromberg and the queen of rockabilly, Wanda Jackson. Plus, a heartwarming Achievement Award story about a young woman feeding the hungry. This week in E-Town.
Tuesday at noon on KRVS.
Public radio for Acadiana. KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.